Please keep Mark 8 where you can see it, because that's where we'll be for these next minutes. It's a very good question to ask someone who's unfamiliar with Christian things, whether they have read one of the Gospels since they became an adult. The answer is usually no. They have a vague recollection of the Bible from childhood, but not much more than that. Now, someone like that, listening to what Alice just read to us, might well say, but that's odd, I thought Jesus fed 5,000. And Mark says there are 4,000. Little head scratching. Maybe that's you, even you this morning. Well, it is true. Jesus did feed 5,000 people at one time, and that's recorded for us in chapter 6, but here in chapter 8, 4,000. And there are real similarities between the stories, such that some more critical Bible scholars have said this is clearly a repeat account of the same thing. It can only have happened once. In fact, some of them probably think it never happened at all. And they hear the disciples in verse 4 asking Jesus, how can one feed these people with bread here in this desolate place? And the scholars suggest there's no way they could ask that question. It's exactly what happened last time. And they saw what happened. They witnessed the phenomenon of 5,000 people fed from 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And there's no other way they could forget that. So they couldn't possibly have asked the question a second time. That's what they say. Well, Mark is recording much of the teaching of Peter, who was there, and is certainly a lot nearer to the event than you and I are. And Mark is quite clear in his record here that these are two separate events. There are differences as well as similarities. For instance, just a little one. If you go back to chapter 6, well, don't turn back to it, but if you were to read this story in chapter 6, the crowd is told to sit down not just on grass, but on the green grass. Little eyewitness touch. Because grass was not green, is not green for long in that part of the world. Just a few weeks at springtime, it identifies it. He was there. He saw the grass was green. This time, chapter 8, they are just told to sit down on the ground. It's a little difference, but it's significant. Time has moved on. This is a different occasion. And more to the point, the disciples' hesitation here is surely true to Christian experience, certainly true to mine. I wonder whether you've been faced with a personal crisis of some kind. Some stage you have cried out to the Lord for rescue and help, hardly daring to believe that it could come. And then marvelously he has answered your prayer and you've received that help in an unforgettable way. And then you promise him that you'll never be unbelieving and never be disobedient again. You'll be perfect from now on. And then 18 months later a very similar situation occurs and you are just as unbelieving and panicky as you were then. So their wavering and uncertainty here isn't really hard to understand. Scholars may not relate to it, but they live in ivory towers. The Bible lives in the real world, and this is very true to life. And we need to remind ourselves of why Mark is writing his gospel. The repeated question from the beginning of the gospel concerns the identity of Jesus. That is the big question. Who is this man? It was the great question at the time, and it is still the great question for everybody today. Many people don't realize that. Most people don't realize that. Ask them what Christianity is about. They may give you all sorts of strange and wonderful answers, but they will usually miss this most basic of points, that Christianity is about Jesus, which is why we talk about him so much, or should. Sometimes the church gives the impression of talking about everything except Jesus. The Reverend David Robertson is the moderator of the Free Church of Scotland. Now, in our denomination, we have bishops and archbishops and things, but in Scotland, they have moderators. And David Robertson said this recently, and I quote, "Here's an interesting thing." I can't do accents. You can imagine the accent for yourself. "Here's an interesting thing," he says. "I do a lot of work with journalists. I did an interview with a journalist, and we talked for about an hour, and then he switched off his recorder because he obviously didn't want this recorded. And he said to me, 'David, you are very, very unusual, because I interview lots of church leaders, and from beginning to end, all you've done is talk about Jesus.' You know what church leaders talk about? They talk about the work they're doing for the poor, and this and that, and all that other stuff." And I said, "Well, I agree with doing that." And he said, "Yes, but as somebody who's disillusioned with the church, I don't want to hear about the church doing social work. We don't need the church to do that. I want to hear about God and what the Bible says." It's very striking, that, isn't it? From a purely secular, skeptical, non-religious journalist. "I want to hear about God and what the Bible says." Well, no better place to look in that case than a narrative like this one, which is all about Jesus. And what we have here is four vignettes, four little pictures of Jesus mingling with crowds large and small. We find him compassionate, we find him frustrated, we find him issuing a warning, we find him questioning. And we'll look at, and that's all in the space of 21 verses, and we'll begin by looking at his compassion first in this remarkable story of the feeding of the 4,000 in verses 1 to 10. I won't read it again, I suspect you're familiar with it, but it does lead us essentially to the compassion of Jesus. Jesus' compassion is the motivation for his miraculous feeding in both of these accounts, both the 5,000 and the 4,000. We're told that he saw the crowd and had compassion on them. But that compassion is prompted by different perspectives. And again, these are clearly different events. Back in chapter 6 with the 5,000, he sees the crowd and has compassion for them because they are harassed and helpless. Whenever I'm in London going up and down escalators of the tube, I find myself drifting to that thought. Crowds of people harassed and helpless. And they're like sheep without a shepherd. And so he begins to teach them. What they need is his teaching about God and the kingdom. Chapter 8 is different. In verse 2 and 3, he has compassion on the crowd because they've got nothing to eat. And if he sends them away hungry, they'll faint. They're hungry. And so he provides food for them. And the compassion of Jesus is very, very broad. He's concerned for people's spiritual and material needs, for food of both kinds, for daily bread as well as for the bread of life. It's his compassion that moves him to teach the crowds and to heal the sick and to feed the hungry. There's tremendous compassion in the heart of Jesus. But within that broad compassion, the priority of spiritual feeding is very, very clear. Material needs are very important, but the needs of the soul are more important still. And that has always been so, and always will be. So here is the compassion of Jesus laid before us. And divine compassion did not begin with the coming of Jesus into the world. We mustn't think that. Looking at him, we see clearly what the living God is and always has been like. And now he is here in person. He is the God who's speaking through Hosea, the prophet, about the dire state and the thankless disobedience of his chosen people. He is the God who ought, in one sense, at that stage, should have had nothing more to do with them, should have abandoned them to their stupid, self-chosen fate. And yet he says, even then, he says, how can I give you up? How can I give up my people? How can I hand you over, O Israel? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. This is Old Testament language. And we see the heart of God himself as we watch Jesus now moved with compassion for a hungry crowd. And he's moved. And his compassion leads him to do something. We can be moved, can't we, by human need. We saw that heart-wrenching picture of a little four-year-old refugee drowned and washed up on the shore. And we feel compassion, but our compassion often goes no further than feelings. And then it recedes. Whereas Jesus' compassion leads to action. And hungry people are fed. And notice they are not just fed, they are well fed. A friend of mine suffers when away from home from what he calls portion anxiety. He has a good appetite and his wife feeds him well, but he gets worried if he has to eat elsewhere. Portion anxiety. Well, he would have had no worries if he'd been here amongst the 4,000. It's in verse 8, they ate and were satisfied. They ate and were satisfied. And there is quite a bit left over. There's no shortage here. Compassion leads to action, and of course it is a miraculous action because this is the Son of God. Who is this man who can do these things? You may possibly be familiar with what I refer to as the packed lunch theory of this explanation of this miracle. Some school teachers, some surprisingly sensible Bible commentators subscribe to it. What really happens, they say, is they're all sitting there. They've all brought their sandwiches with them, but they're too embarrassed to be the first to start. And they might have to share what they brought, so nobody does. And then what really happens is that somebody gets out a packed lunch and everybody else gets theirs out. And they all share it together. And that's how we manage to feed 4,000 people, not with just a few loaves and fishes, but everybody shares their packed lunches. And the real miracle, I tell us, that Jesus overcomes human selfishness. And that's the real miracle. which is a lovely idea. It's just not what we're told in the story, and Mark is much nearer to it than we were and are. He tells it both here and in chapter 6, makes it very plain that this is absolutely miraculous. Whether the crowd realized that is neither here nor there. The disciples did. And herein Jesus is the one whose heart not only goes out to hungry people, but who is more than able to meet them at their point of need. So compassion cries out to us here, shouts to us from these verses. And then we meet a little paragraph in verses 11 to 13 where we find not compassion but frustration. Frustration. The Pharisees came and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. And he sighed deeply in his spirit and said, "Why does this generation seek a sign? Truly I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation." It may seem a little surprising that the Son of God can appear frustrated, but he is a real man and he knows what that means. And it's surely the case with these Pharisees who come and begin to argue with him. They want a sign, they want proof that God is with him. They seem to know that he can work miracles. That doesn't seem to be a problem for them. Right back in chapter 3, we find that. The evidence was so clear before their eyes that they didn't deny that he was a miracle worker, but they did deny that he was a good miracle worker. And they attributed his miracle-working powers to the devil, to the powers of evil, to the occult. The prince of demons is the one behind what Jesus is doing. And their demand for a sign, for proof, is not very different from some people today. There have always been and will always be people who demand that God prove himself by spectacular miracle of some kind. Write a message in the sky and then I'll believe. And of course they never get it any more than the Pharisees do here. Because these are men who have already made up their mind. They do not want to recognize in Jesus the power and the presence of Almighty God. And they'll find any way to wriggle out of what they see. And the demand for a sign is just one big exercise in wriggling. And they engage him with questions and demands, but the reality is they do not want to know. And so Jesus will not do what they ask. He just sighs deeply in his spirit. He sighs at the top of the page, chapter 7, verse 34, when he's faced with physical needs. And he sighs. But when he's faced with this kind of thing, with human willfulness and resolute unbelief, that is more grievous to him than illness of the body. And he sighs deeply and groans because this kind of human stubbornness is so much harder to overcome. And it was ever thus. And he doesn't try to overcome it. I usually feel the same when Jehovah's Witnesses come to the vicarage door. They're very eager to talk. And they admit who they are these days. They used to keep quiet, but now they say jw.org or something. And they're often very nice people, but they do not want to know. Their only concern is for your scalp and to win you over to their side. And they're very confident. They come to the vicarage, and obviously they think they can get mine. And they're programmed to answer all the obvious Christian objections, but they have no intention of engaging with the real issues. Such the conversation with them usually, though not always, usually is a monumental waste of time. And that's what's the case here. Jesus' response, verse 12, he sighed deeply and said, "No sign will be given. God cannot be ordered about like this. He has no need to hurry in with miracles on demand. The Bible contains all the evidence anybody could ever need in order to come to full faith in Jesus, his son. And if they won't act on that, then signs and wonders will make no difference at all." And verse 13 is factual. It's what happened. He left them, got into the boat again and went out to the other side. But it is more than factual. It is very sobering to see what Jesus does. He leaves them and goes to the other side. There is a definite closing of the door on these frustrating interferers. He sees no point in continuing the conversation with people who don't want to know. And he removes himself. He goes out of reach to the other side. It's very deliberate. Now today, some people are determined to leave God out of the picture, like the Pharisees, to find any reason, however flimsy and feeble, not to recognize Jesus and to follow him. Now, Jesus' departure to the other side is a rather sobering reminder that if someone is determined to leave God out of the picture, that someone will find at the end of life that there is no place for them in God's picture. The door does not remain open forever, and it will surely close one day on those who insist on looking the other way. Why does this generation, this society, says Jesus, seek a sign. No sign will be given. And that's the reality. Of course, it's not his desire. This is the man of compassion. His desire is for the opposite. But his frustration is there with those who behave doggedly in this way. Now, moving on to verses 14 and 15, which are all part of one paragraph in our version here. 14 and 15 are a separate little section, really. Just two verses, but very significant ones. Here we find Jesus warning. A warning from Jesus. They've forgotten to bring bread, and they've only got one loaf. And he cautioned them, saying, watch out, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. Leaven is not something we refer to much, is it? They'd recognize it as essential in bread making. It's loaded with symbolism. Leaven, yeast, is almost always a negative symbol in the New Testament. It is a common matter for that evil tendency in the human heart, which, if not checked and dealt with, will in time work its way right through and corrupt the whole person. Leaven is very powerful stuff. Handle with care. Or as Jesus says here, watch out. Beware of leaven of two different kinds. The leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. The leaven of the Pharisees, what is that? This is the snide cynicism of religiously minded people. The Pharisees were very religious, very moral upright, very religious, and most of them were extremely unhelpful in their influence. They represent the religious establishment of the day, greatly respected in their time, knew their Bible very well, but misunderstood it almost completely. And they were relentlessly hostile to Jesus. The leaven of the Pharisees. Religious people, including those who call themselves Christian, can be among the fiercest opponents of Jesus Christ. Now, if you have any awareness of what's going on in the Church of England, or more widely what's called the Anglican Communion at the moment, you'll know what I mean by that. People in positions of responsibility and influence can be very scornful of those who want simply to live under the authority of God's gracious word. There's nothing new in that. Again, if you notice a little church history, just in our own land no further, you'll know that it was true of Wesley and Whitfield in the 18th century. It was true of Latimer and Cranmer and Ridley in the 16th. It was true of John Wycliffe in the 14th. It has always been like that. Religious cynicism is peculiarly unpleasant. But it will be with us till the Lord's return. And he says, watch out for it and do not succumb. Do not let it worm its way into your own thinking and attitudes and life. That's the leaven of the Pharisees. The leaven of Herod is different. This is the influence of the openly, brazenly ungodly, like King Herod at the time. He was one such. Chapter 6 records John the Baptist talking straight to him about his adulterous relationships and having his head chopped off for his pains. Herod stands for the person and the mindset that makes no pretense at all of having any interest in religion. And that mindset, of course, is more and more evident in our own generation. So here is A.A. Gill, the TV critic of the Sunday Times, writing recently about Mrs. Malcolm Uggeridge and Mrs. Mary Whitehouse and her campaign to clean up British television. He refers to Mary Whitehouse as a kind of Dickensian Edna Everage, fluffed up with righteous shock and awe on behalf of ordinary, decent folk. And A.A. Gill, just the other week, goes on to say, now for you millennials who won't remember Malcolm Muggeridge or Mary Whitehouse, she represented a type of odd Christian prudery that doesn't exist in any mainstream sense today. You can sense the relief there. Mary Whitehouse's National Viewers and Listeners Association was bigger than the Labour Party at the time of going to press. She got pop songs pulled from the radio. She bent the ear of governments and directors general and was roundly and deeply and rightly loathed by all programme makers with her view that television should be made with a moral purpose. Could hardly be more contemptuous than that. Well, if you're old enough to remember Mary Whitehouse, millennials won't, but I do. You'll probably remember there was a certain eccentricity in the good lady, a middle-aged housewife with large spectacles. She was quite easy to mock and make fun of, and people did. But she was a brave woman who loved Christ very deeply and loved her country very deeply, and she did what she did out of love for him and genuine compassion for her fellow humans. And our column in a national newspaper gives thanks for our deliverance from such things. In our more enlightened day, deliverance from old-fashioned Christian prudery, and we are to rejoice that such things don't exist anymore. And he might have gone on to say, of course, now we just have the Book of Mormon on the West End stage and are called on to delight in its irreverence and its muck. Well, if A.A. Gill can't handle Mary Whitehouse, I can't imagine what he'd say if he read Ephesians 5. Sexual immorality, covetousness must not even be named among you as is fitting among saints. Presumably that is the source of old-fashioned Christian prudery. And contempt for the clear-cut Christian conceals a deeper contempt for Christ. And that is the reality, and it's very, very sobering. Jesus' warning, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod, is very pertinent today. He says to you and me, do not let the everyday attitudes, do not let religious and secular skepticism, the assumptions of our society as you encounter them day after day, do not let those things form your own attitudes and views. Do not let them work away like leaven, because if you do, they will end up taking you over and ruining you. Watch out, beware. So many people, including not a few I've known here over the years, so many people come near, even very near, to Christian commitment, only to veer away at the last minute, and very often it's because of fear of what other people will think, the modern equivalent of the Pharisees or of Herod. They don't want to be different, and are afraid of standing out from the crowd. But the disciples are learning that if they're going to follow Jesus, they've got to stand out from the crowd. So there is compassion here, a heart of deep compassion, there's frustration with these wretched people who will not, who insist on behaving the way they do. There's warning for the disciples who are so very vulnerable. And then in verses 16 to 21, lastly, we find Jesus probing. He asks probing questions, one after another. Eight of them, in fact, in just five verses. Why is he suddenly asking questions? He's not been doing that before. Well, he's the master teacher, isn't he? And asking good questions is a good way to teach because it makes people think. And so many people are not Christian because they never get round to thinking. Signs of the kind demanded by the Pharisees would leave no room for thought, no room for reflection, no room for personal response and decision. But personal response, personal decision freely made is, of course, what Jesus is looking for. Sober, sensible, realistic decisions to follow him in the light of all the facts. Well, the disciples haven't got there yet. And if he's frustrated with the Pharisees, he's also frustrated, though not in a final way, by the disciples. You see, verse 17, Jesus is aware of the fact they're talking about. He talks about the leaven of the Pharisees, and they talk about the bread, and they've got enough loaves. He says, why are you discussing the fact you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive or understand? And then verse 21, after first things, he said to them, do you not yet understand? And they don't. And he obviously wishes that they did. He reminds them in between those two questions of what they've witnessed, of the 5,000 fed with 12 baskets of food left over. He reminds them of the 4,000 with 7 baskets of food left over. Huge, miraculous provision for human need. But they still do not see who this man is with whom they have already lived for a considerable time. And you and I wouldn't have either, of course. Just don't see. Back in 2007, nearly 10 years ago, commuters on the Washington DC metro system find themselves hurrying past a busker with a baseball cap and a t-shirt. He was playing his violin with a cap open for contributions. He was playing well. He played for nearly an hour, played very well. Very, very well, in fact, because he was, in fact, Joshua Bell in disguise, one of today's greatest international violinists. But of the 1,097 people who passed him that morning, the Washington Post were there as well and counting, of the 1,097 people who passed him, only 7 stopped to listen for as much as a minute. And in the course of his nearly hour's recital, he earned $32 and a few cents which would not have been enough to buy him a ticket for one of his own concerts. It's funny what you can miss when it's in front of your eyes and ears. But the problem with the disciples isn't just funny, it goes deeper than that. It's not just that